cigarette of a lengthy interview. And I made it happen. The Lockheed Martin contract that Michael Furlong had secured expired at the end of May 2010, and the money funding Dewey Claridge's network of agents in Pakistan and Afghanistan ran dry. Claridge was angry that the military had chosen not to renew the contract, and even angrier that the CIA seemed to be the reason that the operation had been shut down. He had sent hundreds of intelligence reports to military commanders in Afghanistan, and he sent a message to Kabul on May 15th that he would stop sending the reports so he could prepare approximately 200 local personnel to cease work. But Claridge had no intention of dismantling his network. The very next day, he set up a password-protected website that would allow military officers to continue viewing his dispatches, and he leaned on some wealthy friends to help keep his network afloat. He set up a front company for his operation, the Eclipse Group, and on his website he posted the same types of intelligence reports he had once given to the military. There were specific reports about how Pakistan's ISI was training gunmen to launch attacks into Afghanistan, and about how Pakistani spies were secretly keeping Taliban leader Mullah Muhammad Omar under house arrest so they could later install him as their puppet in southern Afghanistan once American troops left the country. Another report speculated that Mullah Omar had suffered a heart attack and was rushed to the hospital by ISI operatives. He dreamt up ever more exotic schemes to bring down those he thought were trying to undermine the American war effort. For instance, he was convinced that Afghan President Hamid Karzai was secretly negotiating with Iran as part of a desperate attempt to sell out the Americans and remain in power in Kabul, so Claridge cooked up a plan to dig up hard evidence to prove long-standing rumors that Karzai was a heroin addict. The plan was straight from the old CIA playbook of dirty tricks. He would insert an agent into the presidential palace in Kabul to collect Karzai's beard trimmings, run drug tests, and then give the proof to American commanders in Kabul who could confront Karzai with the incriminating evidence and turn the Afghan president into a more pliable ally. He dropped the plan after the Obama administration signaled it was committed to bolstering the Karzai government, not pushing the Afghan president out of power. Even when news of the private spying operation went public and military officials grew worried about accepting information from Claridge's network, he found other ways to get his information to the public. Claridge's friends sent the reports to pro-military writers like Brad Thor, a successful author of spy thrillers who dispensed some of Claridge's information on blog posts. He even pushed information to Oliver North, his old compatriot from the Iran-Contra days, now an on-air personality on Fox News. It was just like the old days, when Dewey and Ollie were doing the work they thought nobody else had the guts to do. Chapter 12. The Scalpel's Edge. A quote by President Ali Abdullah Saleh. "We'll continue saying the bombs are ours, not yours." The meeting was set up for a surrender, a symbolic gesture of peace timed to the holy month of Ramadan. The Saudi minister had even sent his personal jet to pick up the frail young man in Yemen and deliver him to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia's second city built along the shores of the Red Sea. There, Prince Mohammed bin Nayef was conducting the Ramadan custom of greeting well-wishers at his home, and he gave an order to his coterie of aides that Abdullah al-Asiri be allowed to bypass normal security procedures and not be searched as he entered the palace. Al-Asiri had contacted Prince bin Nayef, the assistant interior minister and a member of the Saudi ruling family, days earlier, announcing his intention to surrender to the Saudi spy service and provide information about the group he had joined 2 years earlier, an offshoot of Osama bin Laden's terror network that had recently rebranded itself Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or ACAP. The group considered Prince bin Nayef its bête noir, a man committed to crushing Sunni extremism in both Saudi Arabia and Yemen, the country's impoverished neighbor to the south. In 2003, when militants in Yemen launched a 20-month campaign of violence inside Saudi Arabia, blowing up Saudi government buildings and oil facilities, bombing residential compounds used by foreigners, and beheading Westerners, bin Nayef ordered a bloody crackdown involving arresting and torturing thousands of suspects rounded up inside the country. He posted informants inside mosques he believed had been infiltrated by extremists. Bin Nayef's aggression against Al-Qaeda had made him a friend of the Bush administration, and by the summer of 2009, a new American president and his aides already considered the prince an indispensable ally. He regularly received dignitaries from Washington, including a visit in May 2009 from a veteran diplomat whom President Obama had just charged with trying to manage an acceptable end to the war in Afghanistan. But when Richard Holbrooke met the prince in Riyadh to solicit the kingdom's help with a war America was losing, the prince warned that the United States might have a far greater worry than the spiraling violence in Afghanistan. "We have a problem called Yemen," bin Nayef told Holbrooke. The prince ticked off a list of worries to the American envoy. Yemen's tribes were more sympathetic to Al-Qaeda than were Afghans, and Yemen was closer to Al-Qaeda's targets in Saudi Arabia than was Afghanistan. Yemen was a failed state, he said, with a weak and corrupt leader in President Ali Abdullah Saleh, whose vision for the country had shrunk to Sana'a, keeping the capital and his base secure. Saleh had always managed to keep Yemen's tribes in check, he said, but the president was losing control and passing more power over to his son, who didn't have close ties to the tribes. Cash payments to Saleh's government were useless, the Saudi said, because the president and those around him move the money out of the country as soon as it arrives. "The money ends up in Swiss bank accounts," Prince bin Nayef told Holbrooke. Instead, the Saudi government had begun paying for development projects in areas of Yemen where Al-Qaeda militants had put down roots, in the hope that the projects might drain away support for extremists and persuade Yemenis to see extremists as criminals rather than heroes. At the end of their meeting, Holbrooke promised the prince that President Obama would work with the kingdom to dismantle Al-Qaeda's growing network in Yemen. It was a stroke of luck, bin Nayef figured, when Abdullah al-Asiri contacted the Saudis 3 months later with his offer to surrender. Al-Asiri was one of 85 militants associated with deviant groups that the Saudis had been hunting, as was the young man's older brother, Ibrahim. Ibrahim had been arrested for trying to join the insurgency in Iraq in 2003, and his time in prison in Saudi Arabia had kindled in him a hatred for the kingdom and its alliance with the United States, which he likened to the relationship between master and slave. Of the two brothers, it was Ibrahim whom the Saudis considered far more dangerous. He had been trained as a bomb maker, with a sinister gift for finding creative ways to hide explosives. Conscious that the Saudis might suspect the planned surrender was an elaborate subterfuge for the al-Asiri brothers to take revenge against Prince bin Nayef, Ibrahim devised a bomb that could evade standard security precautions. Shortly before the younger al-Asiri boarded the Saudi royal's jet for the flight to Jeddah, Ibrahim had a bomb of pentaerythritol tetranitrate, a type of plastic explosive, implanted in Abdullah's rectum. But for all of Ibrahim's genius as a bomb maker, his lethal plots were often undone by the incompetence of his bombers. His brother had traveled with the hidden explosive from Yemen to Jeddah and arrived without incident at Prince bin Nayef's palace. As a nervous Abdullah al-Asiri entered the room where the prince was receiving visitors, he pulled out a cell phone to trigger the explosives, but set the bomb off too early, before he was close enough to the prince. The explosion blew al-Asiri in half, leaving a smoking crater on the tiled floor and bloodstains throughout the room. Prince bin Nayef received only minor wounds from the blast. The attack was a failure, but al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula had managed to carry out its first operation outside of Yemen. If the group was embarrassed by the clumsiness of its assassin, it gave no indication in a boastful message it released shortly after the attack. It was the Saudis who should be embarrassed, the statement read, because Abdullah al-Asiri's security breach was the first of its kind in Saudi Arabia's history, and the militant group was in the process of uprooting a Saudi spy network in Yemen that the royal family had set up to infiltrate ACAP. For those in Riyadh now living in fear, and those in Washington now paying attention, the statement promised more attacks to come. O tyrants, rest assured that you will suffer because your fortress won't be able to protect you from us. We will reach you soon. The day after Barack Obama was sworn in as the 44th President of the United States, Prince bin Nayef received a call from an old friend in Washington. The man on the other end of the phone was John Brennan, a former top CIA officer who had advised Senator Obama during the campaign and had been tapped as Obama's senior counterterrorism advisor in the White House. It wasn't the job Brennan had wanted. During the presidential campaign, he was assumed to be the leading candidate to take over the CIA were Obama elected. He had the right credentials. A son of Irish immigrants, Brennan was raised in New Jersey and attended Fordham University. He had spent decades as a CIA analyst and spoke fluent Arabic. He even had the rare experience of serving as a CIA station chief in Riyadh in the 1990s, despite being an analyst, not an undercover case officer. A large man with a face that looked like it had been carved from a slab of limestone, Brennan had the appearance of a Depression-era boxer, but his dream of taking over the CIA was thwarted during Obama's transition when remarks he had made, seeming to endorse the brutal interrogation methods the CIA had used in secret prisons, resurfaced and were criticized by human rights activists. Brennan had been among George Tenet's top advisors when the prison program was put in place in 2002, and therefore was closely tethered to a program that Obama had frequently said was a dark stain on America's record since the September 11 attacks. Fearing a lengthy and distracting confirmation battle in the Senate, Brennan withdrew his name from consideration for the CIA job. The position in the White House may have been a consolation prize, but in a short time, Brennan would turn his windowless basement office in the West Wing into an operations hub for the clandestine wars that President Obama would champion as president. Obama's desire to manage aspects of the targeted killing program directly from the White House gave Brennan a role unique in the history of American government, one part executioner, one part chief confessor to the president, one part public spokesman sent out to justify the Obama doctrine of killing off America's enemies in remote parts of the world. When Brennan called bin Nayef that day in January 2009, he pledged to the man he had come to know well since his days in Riyadh that President Obama was just as committed to hunting and killing terrorists as President Bush had been. During the transition after Obama's election, Brennan and the other senior members of Obama's national security team had been briefed over 2 days at CIA headquarters, where top agency officials ran through the list of covert action programs on the books. The head of the Counterterrorism Center, the undercover officer with the first name Mike, told the group that President Bush had accelerated the pace of drone strikes the previous summer and that the CIA was trying to get more spies into Pakistan. During the presidential campaign, Obama had repeatedly pledged that he would focus attention on Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the hunt for Osama bin Laden, a renewed emphasis on the so-called good war that Bush had ignored by starting the bad war in Iraq. At the meetings, Brennan told Mike and Stephen Kappas, the deputy CIA director whom Obama had asked to stay in his job at Langley, that the drone killings in Pakistan were likely to continue under Obama's watch. There was another reason that Obama, Brennan, and other senior members of the new administration would come to rely on targeted killing as an important instrument of counterterrorism. During the campaign, Obama had often spoken about how the secret detentions and interrogation techniques of the Bush era had sullied America's image, and during his first week in office, he announced a plan to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay and ban all of the coercive interrogation methods used by the CIA since the September 11 attacks. The decision was immediately denounced by Dick Cheney, the former vice president, as a cynical move by a callow president playing politics at the expense of national security. If there was a major terrorist attack while Obama was president, Cheney warned, it would be Obama's fault for denying the CIA the tools it needed to keep the country safe. Cheney's vituperative comments, coming immediately after he left the White House, were a significant breach of the standard protocol that an outgoing administration doesn't criticize the incoming president, at least in the early months. But the Cheney critique was meant as a warning shot, a signal that any evidence of Barack Obama being weak on national security issues would become grist for partisan attacks against the new president. As he sat in the meetings with the new team, John Rizzo, a career CIA lawyer who had achieved a degree of infamy for his role in getting Justice Department approval for the CIA's detention and interrogation program, was struck by the hawkish tone of Obama's aides. They never came out and said they would start killing people because they couldn't interrogate them. But the implication was unmistakable, Rizzo said. Once the interrogation was gone, all that was left was the killing. The options for interrogating prisoners weren't, as Rizzo said, gone. But interrogation and detention had clearly become a briar patch for the new administration. Besides the decision to shut Guantanamo Bay within a year, there were also concerns among Obama's team that capturing prisoners and handing them over to foreign governments could ignite liberal criticism that the administration was outsourcing torture. At the same time, no prominent member of President Obama's own party had criticized drone strikes, and Republicans were hardly in a position to challenge the new president for fighting too aggressive a campaign against terrorists. The political conditions were set for an escalation of the secret wars. The meetings over 2 days at Langley were the first sign that President Obama planned to rely on the CIA and Joint Special Operations Command in ways that not even George W. Bush and Dick Cheney had as America's primary tool to conduct lethal operations. 7 years after the September 11 attacks, the wars of Iraq and Afghanistan had exhausted the American public and drained the American purse. More important, though, the tools of secret war had been calibrated and refined during that period, and Obama's team thought they saw an opportunity to wage war without the staggering costs of the big military campaigns that topple governments, require years of occupation, and catalyze radicalization throughout the Muslim world. As Brennan described the Obama administration's approach during one speech, the United States could use a scalpel rather than a hammer to carry out war beyond war zones. Obama wasn't the first liberal Democratic president to embrace black operations. John F. Kennedy gave final approval for the Bay of Pigs operation and ramped up covert operations in Vietnam. And, for all the time that Jimmy Carter spent railing against CIA adventures as a presidential candidate, he ended up authorizing a string of covert actions during his final 2 years in the White House. But Barack Obama was also the first president to enter the White House who had come of age after the Vietnam War and the roiling events of the 1960s and 1970s that had fostered cynicism among an earlier generation about the CIA and, more broadly, about the use of American power overseas. In one 2010 interview, Obama told reporter Bob Woodward that he was probably the first president who was young enough that the Vietnam War wasn't at the core of my development, and so he grew up with none of the baggage that arose out of the dispute of the Vietnam War. It was an answer to a question about the tensions between the military and civilians during the Vietnam era, but clearly Obama also had a view of the CIA that was generationally different from that of baby boomers like Bill Clinton. The CIA's ascendancy during the Obama administration wasn't just about the age of the man sitting in the Oval Office or about the nature of the threats Obama learned about each day during his intelligence briefing. It also had to do with the fact that Obama's first CIA director turned out to be, in terms of his ability to advance the spy agency's interests inside the executive branch, the most influential CIA director since William Casey during the Reagan administration. Leon E. Panetta seemed at first an extremely unlikely choice to take over the CIA. He had no professional background in intelligence or military affairs outside of a 2-year army stint in the 1960s. During his years as a Democratic congressman representing a coastal pocket of Northern California, he never served on the committees overseeing either the Pentagon or the CIA. He was outwardly warm and avuncular, but also a fierce backroom negotiator and fighter, who slung four-letter words around a room as frequently as he did prepositions. He had had glancing contact with the intelligence world during his time as President Clinton's chief of staff, but that had been a very different era and a very different CIA. When Panetta took over as CIA director, he had literally no idea that the CIA was killing people around the world. By early 2009, the CIA's targeted killing campaign using drones in Pakistan was being extensively reported in the press, and yet, incredibly, Panetta was shocked to learn during his initial briefings for the CIA job that he would be, in effect, a military commander for a secret war. "He was a total blank slate on intelligence issues when he walked into the door at Langley," said Rizzo, who had helped prepare a set of briefings for Panetta before his Senate confirmation hearings. But what he lacked in tangible experience in issues of life and death, he made up for in Washington savvy. Panetta had two of the qualities the ever-paranoid CIA looked for in a director: clout and respect within the White House, and a willingness to defend the CIA's turf against the agency's perceived enemies in Washington. Both of these qualities were tested immediately after White House officials decided to end a long-standing legal battle and declassify the internal memos authorizing the CIA's interrogation methods during the early years of the Bush administration. Panetta had already made his views on the interrogation methods known during his confirmation hearings, saying unequivocally that they were nothing short of torture. The statement had sent shocks through parts of the CIA's clandestine service and created suspicions that the new CIA director was going to be the second coming of Stansfield Turner, an outsider that a liberal president sent out to Langley to rein in what the White House believed was a spy agency out of control. But the very opposite happened. Panetta became a CIA champion, beloved by many at Langley, but criticized by others who said that, like so many CIA directors before him, he had been co-opted by the agency's clandestine branch. Within a month of his arrival, He had managed to delay the release of the interrogation memos and forced a debate inside the White House about the propriety of spilling all the details of the defunct prison program. Panetta had by that time experienced firsthand the influence that the CIA's Directorate of Operations has over spy chiefs at Langley. Both Stephen Kappes and officers at the Counterterrorism Center warned him that releasing the memos would devastate morale inside the CTC. The warning came with an implied threat. He risked permanently losing the support of the agency's clandestine workforce before he had even figured out how to get from his office to the CIA cafeteria. Panetta had spent enough time in Washington to know the implications of what he was hearing. He risked becoming another John Deutsch or Porter Goss, men who had clashed with the Directorate of Operations and found their tenor at the agency to be nasty, brutish, and short. Panetta was sold. He was on his first overseas trip as CIA director when he learned about the White House's plans to declassify and release the interrogation memos, complying with a federal judge's order in a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit brought by the American Civil Liberties Union. He immediately called Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, and urged him to put off the release. The two men had known each other from the Clinton White House, and it was Emanuel who had pushed for Panetta's appointment to the CIA. Emanuel went along with Panetta's request, and in the weeks that followed, Panetta made an impassioned case at the White House for keeping the memos secret, winning Emanuel over to his side. It was a curious, almost otherworldly moment. A man who had publicly accused the CIA of breaking American law by committing acts of torture was forcefully arguing that the details of those acts be kept secret from the public. Panetta ultimately lost the debate, and President Obama ordered that the memos be released, but it hardly mattered for the new CIA director. By insisting that the White House at least debate the issue, he had proved to the agency's rank and file that he had clout inside the new administration. More important, he had gone to the mat on an issue that was deeply important to the clandestine service. He had shown, as many inside the CIA saw it, that he was part of the team. It was another matter entirely for the man who, at least on paper, was Leon Panetta's boss. Admiral Dennis Blair, who had been sent to the CIA during the Clinton administration to serve as a liaison to the Pentagon, had vaulted up the Navy's senior ranks in the years since and ended his military career as a four-star admiral in charge of the U.S. Pacific Command. The job had given him oversight of more than a third of the Earth's surface, and his orders were obeyed by troops spread across hundreds of thousands of square miles. But Blair, now retired from the military, was taking over a job that remained ill-defined 4 years after the Bush administration created the Director of National Intelligence position under pressure from Congress and the 9/11 Commission to account for the intelligence failures preceding the September 11 attacks and the Iraq War. Some had envisioned the intelligence post to be a powerful job, riding herd over a fractious collection of spy agencies housed in different departments. But Donald Rumsfeld's allies in Congress were successful in neutering the new position, and the Pentagon retained much of the intelligence community's budget. These bureaucratic knife fights meant that by the time Blair took over the post in early 2009, both the Pentagon and the CIA had ensured that he would be little more than a figurehead. Making things worse, Blair saw right away that he was an outsider in a close-knit group of advisors who had been with President Obama through much of the grueling campaign, a group Blair referred to disparagingly as the Long Marchers, in reference to the military retreat over thousands of miles by the Chinese communists in 1934. His suspicions were borne out during an early scrape with Panetta. Blair began pushing for the authority to appoint the senior American spy in each country overseas, a designation that by tradition automatically went to the CIA's chief of station. It was a relatively minor issue, but Panetta and his deputy Stephen Kappas saw it as a threat to the CIA's authority and lobbied the White House to reject Blair's plan. With the proposal languishing at the White House during the summer of 2009, Blair decided he didn't need to wait for a White House decision and issued an order directing the change. He informed Panetta about his decision during a short, tense phone call. Panetta slammed down the phone. "That guy is a fucking asshole," he told a group of aides gathered in his office. The very next day, a secret cable from Panetta was blasted to all CIA stations overseas. The cable carried a simple message: ignore Blair's directive. Not used to having his orders disobeyed, Blair complained to James Jones, Obama's national security advisor, that Panetta was being insubordinate and ought to be fired. The White House sided with the CIA. Blair had long held a dim view of the CIA's history of covert action programs. He believed that too many presidents, too often in American history, used the CIA as a crutch when their advisors couldn't agree on how to handle a particularly thorny foreign policy issue. And, he thought, covert action programs usually lasted years beyond their value to the country. So when, during his first year in office, President Obama ordered a review of the roughly one dozen covert action programs the CIA was carrying out at the time, from the drone strikes in Pakistan to a campaign to sabotage Iran's nuclear work, Blair hoped the process would be a chance to inspect the wiring on each program and decide whether it made any sense to continue it. Instead, the summer 2009 meetings effectively rubber-stamped all of the CIA's secret ventures. At the meetings, Stephen Kappas argued forcefully for why each venture had been a success and needed to continue. By the time a Principals Committee meeting was scheduled for the fall, when President Obama's top national security advisors would make final decisions on the covert action programs, not one of them was under consideration for cancellation. Blair watched with frustration as the process unfolded. He approached Robert Gates, the defense secretary who had spent most of his Washington career in the CIA. Gates had seen his share of covert actions blow up, and Blair knew that Gates had clout inside the White House. Gates agreed with Blair that they should draw up a list of basic principles to guide decisions on covert action programs. The list of six principles they cobbled together were fairly innocuous. They included a provision that covert action programs should constantly be evaluated for transition to non-covert activities, and another that the programs should not undermine the development of stable, non-corrupt, and representative governments that respect the human rights of their citizens. When President Obama's top advisors gathered at the White House to discuss the covert action programs, Blair passed around the list. He and Gates had hoped to turn the meeting into a forum to discuss the general wisdom of CIA covert action, and the meeting dragged on for hours as Blair tried to force a debate about each secret program. Blair recalled that the CIA had wanted to just push covert action programs through, and with each pointed question that Blair asked, both Leon Panetta and Deputy National Security Advisor Tom Donilon grew angrier. It wasn't just that Panetta thought that Blair was grandstanding. He thought that he was attempting to take from the CIA what the spy agency had guarded jealously since its 1947 founding, a direct line to the president for getting covert actions approved. Panetta believed that the list that Blair and Gates had assembled put unnecessary restrictions on President Obama's ability to authorize secret operations. Blair's efforts failed, and the Obama administration approved every one of the covert action programs that had been handed down by President Bush. The CIA had secured yet another victory, and Blair's standing inside the White House was permanently crippled. Even as the Obama administration discussed the future of the CIA's covert action programs, there was no thought about ending the targeted killing efforts. Quite the opposite. In the early months of the administration, National Security Advisor James Jones led a project to compile a centralized kill list for lethal operations beyond declared war zones. What came to be known as the Jones Memo was an early attempt by the Obama administration to establish procedures for the conduct of a secret war that most believed would last years beyond President Obama's time in the White House. The list was maintained by the National Security Council, and as much as some officials tried to keep strict criteria about who could be added to the kill list, those criteria were sometimes eased. At the start of the Obama administration, for instance, the CIA was not authorized to kill Baitullah Masood, who had emerged as the undisputed leader of the Pakistani Taliban since the days when Art Keller first heard his name while serving at one of the agency's bases in the tribal areas. The Pakistani Taliban, known inside the country as the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, or TTP, was attacking Pakistani military installations and government facilities in a grisly spasm of violence. Pakistan's civilian government, which came to power after President Musharraf stepped aside, began pressing the Obama administration to kill Masood with an armed drone, just as the CIA had killed his predecessor, Nek Mohammed. But the answer was no. During one private meeting in early 2009, CIA Deputy Director Stephen Kappas told Hussein Haqqani, Pakistan's ambassador to Washington, that since Masood and his followers had not attacked the United States, the CIA couldn't get legal approval to kill him. Some conspiracy theorists in Pakistan had a more cynical view of why the United States was refusing to kill Masood. That he was, in fact, a secret agent of India, and the United States had promised New Delhi that Masood would not be harmed. But as the Pakistanis continued to press, CIA lawyers began circulating legal memos making a case that since the Pakistani Taliban sheltered Al-Qaeda operatives, and since it was increasingly difficult to distinguish between groups bent on attacking inside Pakistan and those focused on hitting the West, senior TTP leaders could justifiably be put on the kill list. Besides the legal rationale, some thought there could be diplomatic benefits if the CIA were to kill Pakistan's most dangerous enemy. On a warm evening in early August 2009, a CIA drone hovering over the village of Zangara in South Waziristan trained its camera on a rooftop where Baitullah Masood and several members of his family were taking in the night air. Masood, a diabetic, was receiving an intravenous insulin drip when the drone launched a missile that killed everyone on the roof. Pakistani officials cheered the killing, and some in Washington described the drone strike as a goodwill kill. Leon Panetta had taken to his new role as military commander, and his time at Langley would be known for the CIA's aggressive, some would come to believe reckless, campaign of targeted killings. At the end of his CIA tenure, Panetta, a devout Catholic, joked that he had said more Hail Marys in the last 2 years than I have in my whole life. 2 months after Baitullah Masood's killing, Leon Panetta arrived at the White House with a long list of requests for CIA paramilitary operations. He sought more armed drones and approval to ask Pakistan's permission for the drones to fly over larger swaths of the tribal areas, what the CIA called flight boxes. President Obama, at the urging of Vice President Joe Biden, had already agreed to increase the number of covert officers inside Pakistan, many of whom were operating in the country without the knowledge of the ISI. The CIA requests to expand its drone fleet did raise eyebrows, and some officials openly questioned why a spy agency was moving so far from its primary mission of collecting and analyzing intelligence. General James Cartwright, the deputy chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, asked on several occasions, "Can you tell me why we are building a second Air Force?" Others thought that the CIA had become so enamored of its killer drones that it wasn't pushing its analysts to ask a basic question. To what extent might the drone strikes be creating more terrorists than they are actually killing? But by the end of the meeting in the Situation Room, President Obama had granted every one of Panetta's requests. "The CIA gets what it wants," the president said. But even with the new resources, the CIA's war in the mountains of Pakistan still consumed the bulk of the intelligence community's drones, spy satellites, and case officers. That left little for a different war, 3,000 miles to the west, that President Obama's advisers were quietly expanding. The assassination attempt on Prince Binayev in August 2009 created a new urgency in Washington to take on the al-Qaeda-affiliated group in Yemen that had announced its intentions to strike at the West. In late 2009, there was only a small cluster of American soldiers and spies stationed inside the U.S. Embassy in Sana'a. In addition to the CIA's station in the country, the Pentagon had kept a group of special operations troops in Yemen since 2002, but the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan had for years been a higher priority than the mission in Yemen. But with the Iraq war now winding down, Joint Special Operations Command had more Navy SEALs to devote to new missions. General David Petraeus, the commander of American forces in the Middle East, had been worried about the growing influence of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula since he assumed control of U.S. Central Command the previous year. In late September 2009, Petraeus signed off on the classified order to expand American military spying in Yemen and elsewhere, the same order that Michael Furlong had used to justify his intelligence-gathering operation in Pakistan. It authorized the military to conduct a host of unconventional missions in Yemen, from broader eavesdropping activities to paying off locals for information. Admiral William McRaven, the JSOC commander, wanted to use in Yemen the same blueprint that commandos had used in Iraq to fight al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia. Frequent night raids to capture al-Qaeda operatives, interrogate them for intelligence, and then use the information to carry out more snatch-and-grab operations. This model, relying on what commanders called the cycle of intelligence, was already being duplicated in Afghanistan, and McRaven thought that getting more troops into Yemen could cripple ACAP's strength before it could successfully attack the United States. But McRaven's ambitious ideas for Yemen were rejected in Washington as unrealistic. President Saleh of Yemen would never allow American ground troops to set up a detention and interrogation center inside Yemen, let alone permit capture and kill operations throughout the country. The White House had already run into fierce political opposition to its plans to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay, and the president's aides hardly relished the prospect of taking on a slew of new detainees picked up in Yemen. McRaven was told he needed to figure out a different way to wage war in Yemen. What followed was a strange half-baked campaign, a quasi-secret war undermined by sometimes absurd attempts to hide the American hand in military operations. With little precise intelligence about the whereabouts of militant leaders and the Yemeni president's refusal since 2002 to permit armed drones, war planners were forced to rely on cruise missiles fired from Navy ships off Yemen's coast and occasional bombing runs by Marine Harrier jets. The results were unsightly, and over the next several months, the American strikes in Yemen would claim more civilian casualties than senior operatives affiliated with al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. The first American strike came on December 17, 2009. The Americans had intercepted communications from a terrorist camp in Abyan province, a remote expanse of desert and coastal villages running south to the port city of Aden. ACAP was in the final stages of sending a group of suicide bombers to attack the U.S. Embassy in Sana'a. In a video teleconference a day earlier, Admiral McRaven gave a detailed briefing to White House, Pentagon, and State Department officials about his plan to hit the camp. While the CIA generally had blanket approval to carry out drone strikes in Pakistan without getting White House permission, the military required a green light from a small team in Washington, a group nicknamed the Counterterrorism Board of Directors, with John Brennan serving as chairman. The group would decide on a plan and then take its recommendation to President Obama, who personally signed off on each strike. Obama approved the operation. The next day, a coded message went out to a small fleet of American ships patrolling the Arabian Sea, and within hours, several Tomahawk cruise missiles slammed into the desert camp in Abyan. By the end of the day, Yemen's government had put out a press release hailing the success of the operation, saying that a strike by Yemen's Air Force had killed around 34 al-Qaeda fighters. The following day, President Obama called Ali Abdullah Saleh to thank him for his cooperation, even though Yemeni troops had merely been a fig leaf for the American operation. Videos taken by locals at the camp revealed missile fragments with American markings and also proved that the Tomahawk missiles had been topped with cluster bombs, weapons designed to cut a wide path of destruction by dispersing smaller munitions over a wide area. Most of the dead were civilians, and bloody images of dead women and children went viral on YouTube. During a street protest after the strike, broadcast on Al Jazeera, one al-Qaeda fighter shouldering an AK-47 made a direct appeal to Yemeni troops. "Soldiers, you should know we do not want to fight you," he said. "There is no problem between you and us. The problem is between America and its agents. Beware of taking the side of America." 3 weeks after the American strike, General Petraeus arrived in Sana'a to meet with President Saleh and his advisors about the next phase of the war. There was new urgency. On Christmas Day 2009, a young Nigerian man boarded a plane in Amsterdam bound for Detroit, and sewn into his underwear was the latest diabolical creation of Ibrahim al-Asiri, the master bomb maker of Yemen. As the plane made its final descent, Omar Farouk Abdulmutallab tried to set off the bomb, made with 80 grams of plastic explosives, using a syringe filled with liquid acid. Once again, Asiri's work was undone by the incompetence of his bomb carrier. Abdulmutallab set only his leg on fire, and other passengers quickly wrestled him to the ground. The hapless terrorist was taken into custody in Detroit, and the United States only narrowly averted its first large-scale terrorist incident of the Obama administration. While the assassination attempt on Prince bin Nayef had been the first sign of ACAP's ambitions to strike beyond Yemen, the thwarted Christmas attack proved that the group was truly committed to continuing the work begun by Osama bin Laden and his now diminished band of al-Qaeda operatives hiding in Pakistan. When General Petraeus's plane touched down in Yemen's capital in early January 2010, the Obama administration had already decided to escalate the American strikes in the country. President Saleh had long been prickly about allowing Yemen to become a playground for secret American operations. Yemeni president and American officials often degenerated into horse trading sessions. Petraeus began the 90-minute meeting by softening up the Yemeni president. He praised him for his military's successful operations against ACAP and said that he had requested that cash payments to Yemen for counterterrorism operations nearly double, from $67 million to $105 million annually. But the wily autocrat pushed for more. Raising the subject of the recent American airstrikes, Saleh said that mistakes were made in the killing of civilians in Abyan. Tomahawk cruise missiles were ill-suited for a fight against terrorists, and civilian casualties could be averted if only the United States would give him a dozen helicopter gunships to swoop into terrorist camps. This, Saleh said, would allow him to spare the innocent and kill the guilty. If Washington wouldn't bless this request, Saleh said, maybe General Petraeus could pressure Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to contribute 6 helicopters each. Petraeus countered with a request of his own. Allow American special operations troops and spies closer to the front lines in Yemen. That way, Petraeus said, Americans could download intelligence feeds from drone aircraft and satellites and use the intelligence to hit terrorist hideouts with greater speed and precision. Saleh flatly rejected the request and told Petraeus that the Americans must stay inside an operations center that the CIA and JSOC had recently set up just outside of the capital city. But, he said, the air war could continue. He would allow American jets and bombers to loiter offshore and come into Yemeni airspace for specific missions if intelligence emerged about the whereabouts of ACAP leaders. He said he would keep up the ruse that the United States was not at war inside Yemen. "We'll continue saying the bombs are ours, not yours," Saleh said. The United States was slowly getting deeper into a war inside a country that Washington had long ignored and little understood. It was a war against a band of zealots punching above their weight in a fight against the world's only superpower, and the Obama administration still had only the vaguest ideas about how much support the militants had and where they were hiding. It was hard to differentiate between what was real intelligence and what was misinformation handed to the Americans by Yemeni sources advancing their own agendas. 5 months after Petraeus's meeting with Saleh, American missiles blew up the car of Jaber al-Shabwani, the deputy governor of Marib province, and the man President Saleh had tapped to be a liaison between the Yemeni government and the al-Qaeda faction. When al-Shabwani and his bodyguards were killed, they were on their way to meet with ACAP operatives to discuss a truce. But al-Shabwani's political rivals had told American special operations troops in the country a different story, that the Yemeni politician was in league with al-Qaeda. The Americans had just been used to carry out a high-tech hit to settle a tribal grudge. The May 2010 strike provoked outrage across Yemen, and President Saleh demanded a halt to the airstrikes. Locals in Marib set an oil pipeline ablaze, and the fire burned for days. The American war in Yemen was on hold indefinitely. In Washington, America's greatest presidents are memorialized with great monuments, their most famous quotations etched into blocks of white marble. The mediocre presidents get conference rooms in downtown hotels named for them. On April 6, 2010, Dennis Blair descended the stairs into the basement of the Willard Hotel, a warren of conference rooms named after Millard Fillmore, Zachary Taylor, Franklin Pierce, and James Buchanan. There, he delivered what would be his last speech as Director of National Intelligence. Blair's frustrations with the job were mounting, and he knew that support for him was dwindling both within the White House and among Washington's national security intelligentsia. Blair had arrived that morning determined to air his concerns about the CIA and secret operations that he believed had run amok. Though his words were couched in diplomatic language, his message was clear. The United States, he said, too often relied on covert action in a world where secrets were hard to protect and where the hand of the American government was more difficult to keep hidden. There are many more overt tools of national power available to attack problems in areas of the world that were previously the place where only covert action could be applicable. He never mentioned the CIA during the speech, but it was unmistakable that his words were directed at the agency, which he had watched amass tremendous power inside the Obama administration. By going public with his concerns, Blair had violated one of the Obama administration's cardinal rules: keep fights over national security matters inside the family. Even more significant, he was challenging one of the central pillars of President Obama's foreign policy, using the CIA as an instrument of secret war. Predictably, Leon Panetta and other senior officials at the CIA were incensed when they heard about Blair's speech. Just over a month later, President Obama fired Dennis Blair. The CIA gets what it wants. Chapter 13. The Scramble for Africa. A quote by Amira. This is manna from heaven. The MV Faina, a Ukrainian-owned merchant ship, was hugging the coastline of Somalia as it steamed toward Mombasa, Kenya in September 2008, but it would not reach its final port of call. As it navigated a particularly treacherous stretch of water, more than a dozen armed men swarmed the ship in motorized skiffs, taking hostage the crew of 17 Ukrainians, 3 Russians, and 1 Latvian. When they went down into the ship's hold, the pirates couldn't believe their luck. The ship was carrying a clandestine cargo of 33 Russian T-72 tanks, dozens of boxes of grenades, and an arsenal of anti-aircraft guns. The pirates had no way of knowing it, but the cargo had been part of a secret effort by Kenya's government to arm militias in southern Sudan in their fight against the government in Khartoum, a violation of a UN arms embargo. The Somali pirates had become experts in setting ransoms based on the value of their cargo, and soon after the ship's capture, they began demanding as much as $35 million for a safe release of the crew, the ship, and its sensitive cargo. American Navy vessels surrounded the ship within days, and helicopters flew over the Faina's deck in an attempt to assess the health of the crew. But the hostage negotiations dragged on for weeks as the Ukrainian shipowners refused to cave to the pirates' demands. Frustrated by the lack of progress, the pirates decided they wanted a new mediator for the negotiations. They scrawled a message onto a white sheet and draped it over the Faina's railing. The message was just one word long: Amira. Within days, Michelle Amira Ballerin was at the center of the tense hostage negotiations with a group of pirates holding a ship full of Russian tanks. By the time the pirates made their demand, Ballerin had already been working with a group of Somali clan elders to negotiate the ransom and end the standoff, although she would later deny that she had any financial interest in the negotiations. Her interest was purely humanitarian, she said, providing satellite phones so that pirates could communicate with Somali elders on shore and so the Faina's crew could communicate with their families. But the ship's Ukrainian owners grew angry about the meddling of this strange woman from Virginia. Hers was an unwanted presence. They figured she was only driving up the price of getting their crew and cargo released. She has to understand that offering criminals a huge amount of money, which, by the way, she doesn't have, she is only giving them false hope, said a company spokesman. Ukraine's government even intervened. In early February 2009, just weeks after the Obama administration took office, Ukraine Foreign Minister Volodymyr Orizko wrote a letter to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton about the woman who, he said with a flourish, had become an intermediary of the sea corsairs. Ballerin's actions, the Ukrainian minister went on, incite the pirates to the groundless increase of the ransom sum, and he asked Clinton to facilitate the exclusion of her from the negotiation process with the pirates. Hillary Clinton would have had no reason to know who Michelle Ballarin was before receiving the letter from the Ukrainian minister, but plenty of other American officials did. By the time President Obama came into office, Ballarin had been given a contract with the Pentagon to gather intelligence inside Somalia, just one of the myriad projects for which she had tried to gain the approval of the United States government, with varying degrees of success. Her efforts back in 2006 to organize a Sufi resistance to fight al-Shabaab hadn't yet panned out, but she wasn't deterred. Using a number of different front companies with vague and portentous names like Black Star, Archangel, and the Gulf Security Group, she hatched several new ventures designed to make her an indispensable partner to the American military and intelligence services. She converted a historic hotel in rural Virginia into a secure facility with reinforced walls and encrypted locks that she hoped the CIA or Pentagon might use to store classified information. She was unsuccessful in getting any government agencies to rent the space. She hired a number of retired American military officers and spies, including former CIA officer Ross Newland, who had left the spy agency to become a consultant, to help her get meetings with senior members of Washington's national security establishment. Working with a former Army Sergeant Major named Perry Davis, a stocky retired Green Beret with years of military service in Southeast Asia, Ballarin briefly considered the idea of scouting for bases on remote islands in the Philippines and Indonesia she thought could be used to train indigenous troops for clandestine counterterrorist missions, but mostly she kept her focus on Africa. In August 2007, she wrote a letter to the CIA in which she announced herself as the president of Gulf Security Group, a company based in the United Arab Emirates with a singular objective: hunting and killing al-Qaeda terrorist networks, infrastructure, and personnel in the Horn of Africa. The letter went on. Gulf Security Group is owned and controlled by the undersigned United States citizens with no foreign interests or influence. We have deep relationships with indigenous clans and political leaders in Somalia, Kenya, Uganda, and throughout the Horn of Africa, including the Islamic Courts Union and those who control their militant and jihadist activities. These relationships will enable successful mission outcome without fingerprint, footprint, or flag, and provide total deniability. To such a breathtaking proposal, a CIA lawyer sent back a terse response. The CIA is not interested in your unsolicited proposal and does not authorize you to undertake any activities on its behalf. I am returning your proposal, wrote John L. McPherson, the agency's associate general counsel. Ballarin's proposal to cobble together indigenous hit squads, McPherson wrote, might violate the Neutrality Act, a law that prohibits private citizens from raising private overseas armies. As far-fetched as her offer seemed, Ballarin might just have had bad timing. Just a year earlier, the CIA was still paying Eric Prince and Enrique Prado